Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Tracy McClure. Thanks for joining me. Coming up over the next half hour, they live in a camp, but it's no summer vacation resort. We visit a community of Christian Palestinian refugees in Lebanon. And helping people help themselves, feeling the ground before setting up a microcredit industry. We talk to an expert in development. When you think about the 4 million or so Palestinian refugees spread across the Mideast in UN camps, you don't automatically think about many of them being Christian. But on a recent trip to Lebanon, I visited one camp of Palestinian refugees from the 1948 Arab-Israeli War that's made up almost entirely of three generations of Christians who fled the conflict. Some 600 Palestinian Christian and more than 100 poor Lebanese families live in Dibaye camp today. It is a squalid hillside sprawl of ramshackle shacks and beat-up cars just north of Beirut. During Lebanon's war, mostly throughout the 70s and 80s, the camp was severely damaged and destroyed. The UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees, UNRWA, runs a small school there for the some 150 kids, but most families feel forgotten and discouraged. Lebanon refuses citizenship to Palestinian refugees and their children, and that means no access to national social and health services, and they're excluded from being able to work in 72 professions. They're left with the menial manual jobs nobody else wants. Well, Maria is a Christian aid worker from Europe who has lived in the camp for more than 12 years. She asked to remain anonymous, so that's not her real name. I asked her, what are the challenges facing this unusual Christian community in Lebanon?
Christian Palestinian refugees aren't really loved by their brothers, the Muslims, because they're Christians. But they're neither loved by the Lebanese because they're Palestinians, so which gives them kind of isolated status. I think they have big challenges in like brotherhood and solidarity, but when it comes to going back to Palestine, I think very few people think of going back to their home country.
Because they don't want to, or they have given up hope that they will ever really be able to go back.
The younger generation doesn't even think about it. They just want to be Lebanese, have a Lebanese nationality, work here, study here, and have their families here. The older people who might have some homesickness to Palestine, but to a certain extent they think there's no hope anymore to go back.
What about the local Christian community in Lebanon? Have they expressed any sort of solidarity towards this Christian camp?
No, not that I know of.
How many families are actually here? And how many children would be among them?
There are almost 600 Palestinian families and about 120 Lebanese families, because from the beginning people were going and coming, and also Lebanese were displaced people and they came during the war.
And how are they making a livelihood? Are they receiving any assistance? When I walked into the camp, I actually saw an UNRWA, a small office of the United Nations Palestinian Refugee Agency.
The Palestinians are working as laborers, unskilled laborers, most of them. But there are also foreign laborers in the country, so which makes that the Palestinians don't have many chances in finding a job, which is, and for other Lebanese people, the same. Women are sewing in small atelier, or the girls, they work like vendeuses. They sell things. Mm-hmm. They work in a grocery store as a cashier or something like that.
And the men?
Most of the men are unskilled laborers, and the Lebanese, of course, they're fishermen.
And what about schools, education for the young people here?
There's the UNRWA school. The UNRWA doesn't have so many services offered, and their budget is also slowing down. There's the UNRWA school, but then they have to go for the last 2 years before terminal schooling. They have to go to another governmental school, which is not expensive but costs. A couple of them are able to continue university, but most of them are not able. And even if they finish university and they have a degree, they're not able to exercise 72 professions. So there's many chance in obtaining a good job, even if they have the qualifications and even if they have the degrees.
Now, as a foreigner working among these people, what was their reaction when you first came in and offering assistance?
The fact that we've been here with them and living with them makes it much easier because they've become our family. So it's much easier to offer service to somebody who you consider to be a sister or your brother or whatever. They were not hostile at all. They were just welcoming, and as they have been rejected by many other people, they were just grateful. Oh yeah, too.
And what about the pastoral care of this small Christian community? I've heard that there's actually a church and there are some nuns who are taking care of the community. How is that work?
I think like in other parishes, the church is there. There are two rites. There is a Greek Melkite and there is a Maronite rite. Both churches have priests. One is living in. He's one of the Lebanese Maronite monks. The other one is an unmarried Greek Catholic priest, and he's not living in this parish. They have the usual services like for death and funeral, for sacraments. They also have Mass on Sunday, but for the rest there's not really that much of pastoral care. There are many movements, there are many organizations, youth and women and older people, and they're well organized.
It must be a very frustrating job for you, working amongst these people who must themselves be so frustrated by their condition, not being able to work, not being able to have access for their children of a fine education, and their dreams are not being fulfilled, and I'm sure yours aren't either. What do you feel about working in these conditions?
I think it's terrible, and it's not... it's not justice. There should be justice and the right of to learn and to be able to find a job and to live happily. But those people just don't have it. And so many people are suffering from depression, especially the women. Because, you know, the men, they kind of, you know, go out of the house and they have leisure somehow. But the women, they just stay in the house, most of them, and take care of the kids and will also always deprive themselves from things they want to give to the kids. So they're most of it, they're the victims, and they're so depressive, they just don't see any future at all, and many of them take antidepressants.
In your work, how do you try to help them overcome that state of mind, the depression, the frustration of their daily lives?
Well, I would say that listening to them is the first requirement. Feeling with them, listening to them, and then there is also, if they will need skilled help, there is also a psychologist coming to the camp. This was arranged last year when she started coming, and this is a very good thing for the camp. So some people take profit of that. I would say listening, okay, living with them, and trying to do some activities together. Just knowing that solidarity ties them all over the world, not just in this camp. Could be with other people, could be with schools from other countries, with age groups, and working together, having some projects. Just try to build some self-esteem, which they sometimes lack.
Well, the three Belgian Sisters of Nazareth who live in the camp do more than just listen to the problems of the refugees. They got schools in Belgium to fund an operation for a 12-year-old girl suffering from a degenerative skin disease. I talked to her mother, Janet Hanouche.
We are wait for this operation maybe 2 years to get some help, some help to do this operation.
And finally, one of the sisters here in the camp was able to get funding from schools, who was children in Belgium who raised money for this operation. So you are very lucky, but I think
many other people weren't.
I
always thanks God for this, because they help us always, and they pray to us to somebody help us always.
And what is your hope for your children? You said you have 6 children.
Yes, I hope they will have a good job and good family. So, and maybe I hope to go to my family outside, my family in Sweden. I like to go there.
I know it's very difficult here in Lebanon for Palestinians to even have jobs. So what does that mean for you and your children?
Do you know that they didn't like to learn? I have the second daughter, Serani. She knows. She's very clever. She said, "Why I want to have a school Why? I can't have any job. Look, my sister, she haven't any job. And you said, you must to learn. But she said, no way.
How are you able to live? What sort of income do you have to buy the food, to pay for your car, gasoline?
You know, we live in a poor family. Maybe we have some for fruit, some for once a day, matlam, mish every day. When I have money, I bring everything. When I haven't, we didn't talk.
And you don't eat.
Sometimes.
Well, Janet's good sense of humor may be the only thing keeping her sanity in a country some say the international community has forgotten. The Pontifical Missions Office in Beirut helps the Sisters of Nazareth provide social and medical services to the Dubai refugees. Regional Director Issam Bishara says one of the big challenges facing agencies like his is to make sure Lebanon is not forgotten.
During the years of war, the amount of aid that used to come to Lebanon used to be much, much more than what we're getting now. But I think part of our job as NGOs is to keep the awareness with the donor agencies and keep informing them about the difficulties that Lebanon is still facing. It's true we have a government, it's true we have now established a system, but what the donor agencies should know is that the government has a debt of almost $40 billion, and we're talking $40 billion for a small country like Lebanon, and this makes the economic situation very, very difficult. Very few social services are provided by the government. The hospital sector is suffering. Private hospitals are not getting paid what the government owes them. The educational sector, there's a large problem there because there aren't enough public schools for the kids to go to, so they have to go to private schools, which are very expensive. I don't know if you've noticed as well, I mean, the social services provided to the people are very, very few. Minimum salaries are beyond what people actually need to live decently. The minimum wage is $200, while according to the UN, the poverty line falls under $800. So there's a big gap between what someone gets as a salary provided by private or public sector and what he really needs to live.
And my thanks there to the Regional Director for the Pontifical Missions Office in Beirut, Issam Bishara, shining the light there on Lebanon. I came away from Dubai camp with the feeling that despite decades of relying on handouts and the help of UN agencies and NGOs, These Palestinian refugees would much rather be masters of their own lives, their own destinies. But how to go about that if they can't find meaningful jobs? The idea has been percolating in my head for some time now. Find a way to help them help themselves. Why not a microcredit program that would give them the initial cash to start up a small business of some sort? I contacted the sisters at Dabaya Camp and told them of my idea. They were excited by the prospect and promised they'd talk with the women in the community and come up with some project ideas. But before I could talk to the Palestinians about their potential projects, I needed to find out more about microcredit schemes. I hadn't a clue towards getting one off the ground. So I found an expert from the International Fund for Agricultural Development, IFAD, to give me some background information and advice. Miriam Sharagoni is a rural financial expert for IFAD working in Western and Central Africa, with lots of experience managing microcredit programs for small farmers. My Palestinians don't have land to farm, but I was sure she could give me some ideas about where to start.
What you've described here is not only unique to Lebanon. I think it is the whole essence of the microfinance movement in the world, that a lot of people did not have assets to give as collateral, and also that they did not have land to produce something that can be used as collateral, like coffee. And even in Kenya, I mean, not even Palestine, women have a problem because they don't own any assets. And so it's always a problem to access finance, because if you think about finance in the strictest sense, that they would need a collateral. And collaterals are always very specific. And if you don't own a home, I mean, most of the times it is in these patrilineal societies that the inheritance goes to the male. And so, obviously, women are disadvantaged. And so the microfinance movement came about, and it does not require any form of collateral, because what you do is you just get together in a group of five, and these small groups is a self-selecting process where you select who you're comfortable with. And the microfinance institutions would come and train you on how to do this. So if there's no microfinance institution, you can also do it yourself, because in most countries, in Africa particularly, there's lots of just self-help groups that come together to do this. And you can obviously start with a savings mobilization process where you collect savings on a regular basis, first of all, to train them how to save. Once they can save a small amount, it doesn't have to be a big amount, but I think the importance of it is the regularity of savings. And then they can decide, okay, why don't we lend among ourselves to start with? And you can do small businesses like petty trade. You can sell, you know, dumplings. I mean, you can make mandazis. Mandazi is a pastry that you make with wheat flour. And you can stand outside your house and sell it. If you have a fridge, you can make some things for the kids and you can sell them. So this is how the microfinance starts. Of course, you start small like that, and then you build it up, and then you have a shop, and then you build from the shop. And I think it needs some entrepreneurial skills that you have to train them on. And once they start doing this, then they can rent land if they don't have. I'm sure they can rent land from somebody. But they need to have at least a base to start with.
What about external donors? I mean, if I were able to come up with a little bit of money, asking some financial help from some people, you know, could we buy, I don't know, sewing machines and get them some fabric so they could make children's clothes or T-shirts or whatever? Then how does that work? Do they pay us back?
No. I mean, to start, first of all, there's lots of organizations that are involved in work that brings the community to a level that the microfinance institutions or finance institutions can pick up from. And there you cannot, if you want to support them, you can say, okay, we're working in this community. I mean, IFA does this all the time. We're working in this community. We want the really poorer people to rise up to a level that they can access funding, for example. We give them assets. To at least, because that is normally the beginning of owning something, at least a chicken or goats or, you know, small stock. And through this small stock, they can look after them, and it can generate something for them. For the women, it is always, you know, little activities like chicken keeping, you know. And then, of course, those ones you cannot ask them to repay because they need to build up their savings to be able to do something more meaningful. So with that, you can start with grants to them, but it needs to be structured in a way that it can grow into something that they can then get themselves out of poverty. And there are lots of organizations that do this, I'm sure, even in Palestine.
I know a priest in one little village in the Holy Land who was able to get a donation to build an olive press, and the local farmers now have formed a cooperative, and they make their own olive oil, and they export it. He was also able to find a supermarket chain in France which was willing to sell their olive oil in its chains of stores. But how do I help these people find a market for their products?
Okay, there are lots of organizations also who do that, who link farmers to markets, because also that is a very big challenge. For example, in Eastern Southern Africa, we've seen that is a very big problem. And even this morning, we are discussing proposals from different organizations who are interested in doing this with IFAD. And so you do a proposal and you try and solicit for funding to support these groups to link up. For example, Tradecraft, which is a UK organization, was funded to do fair trade and to link farmers from developing countries to supermarkets in the UK. One other interesting one is the World Food Programme, for example. You know, World Food Programme has been involved in relief food, but very recently they've now started a Purchase for Progress. And Purchase for Progress is essentially purchasing from the local countries in order to use this food for the relief work that they do. And the truth is, they are able to buy produce from farmers directly. And so this is one opportunity. I don't know if they are there in Palestine, but I'm sure this is one of the ways that you could assist them with linking them with these organizations.
One thing, since these people don't seem to have any collateral, as you call it, I was thinking something that could also take off there would be internet or computer services of some kind. Are you involved in that in any way in Africa?
Yes, I'll give you an example of one microfinance institution that is doing a lot more than microfinance. For example, based in Kenya, it is called Jamii Bora. Jamii Bora started by experimenting with lending to beggars in the streets. And they've worked with these guys, you know, on savings mobilization. Then they've given them loans, and these guys have grown out of poverty. And recently they started a housing scheme where they could contribute towards owning their own home. And I remember just recently we had the microcredit summit in Kenya, and the Jamii Bora was handing keys of the first beggars that graduated into owning their own homes, and everybody was in tears just to see that it is possible for just an individual, Ingrid, who thought about this and started working with these guys. So there's lots that you can do, even though, you know, it might look difficult, but one person can change the whole way that people see other people. So I think in terms of computers and doing things like this, I mean, that is, to me, a very good thing. For example, you know, these guys are living in small boxes. If there's a way that you can get the government to get them a small land, that you can build a resource facility where you can put the computers and put some TV for the kids and get them some videos to try and see and understand, you know, things and try and even create. In Kenya, for example, we have resource centers where in villages where, for example, Isipe wants to conserve the forest, and the communities have been destroying this forest, and so they set up a resource center where people can go there and learn about protecting forests and how can they live harmoniously with the forest. And they developed little ecotourism centers within the forest where the youth could benefit from taking tourists there. And all of a sudden, a whole enterprise, you know, develops in a community. So each place, there must be something that they have a comparative advantage, and you can just zero in on that and try and work with them to develop that and develop an enterprise out of it.
It's all very interesting, Miriam. Thank you so much for sharing all this with me. Just one more thing. I have two young children, and I'm trying to think, how can I get them involved in doing something positive to help other people? And, you know, I look around and I think, gee, I've got 10 pairs of eyeglasses, old eyeglasses, the prescriptions are no longer good for me, just sitting in a drawer. Couldn't I get
other people like me to donate their glasses, which I'm sure would be very, very useful and are extremely expensive for people in Africa. I mean, what about things like that or bicycles? I understand that bicycles, old used bicycles. I've got one in the garage. My kids have outgrown it. What do I do with it?
In fact, exactly. I mean, this is how you train children. One of the things that, you know, I went to school in Canada, and I learned something there where people are taught to be philanthropic from when they're very small. In Africa, we didn't have that. I found giving is not something that comes natural. You have to teach people how to give. And one of the ways that, for example, in Kenya that I've seen that happening is that there are schools that are normally for well-off families, I mean, like private schools where kids of people who can afford can take their children there. And I'm privileged that my son also goes to a school like that. And what they have done is to try and show these children that they're very privileged and they have too much. they link them with a public school in Islam. And they collaborate with those students. You know, they have exchange visits just for them to see the realities of other children. You know, it is not everyone has everything the way, you know, most kids that are in private schools have. And then they organize to exchange things like, you know, their old shoes, their old uniforms. And they do visits. They do soccer games. They bring clothes from school and give them. And sort of, you know, so you see that they begin to grow together. So you can do such things, which I thought was quite innovative, to try and just pick one school at a time and link with one other school and build one school at a time. The other thing that I also saw is that this problem, in fact, we were just discussing with somebody who works for World Food Program working on girls' education. And she says that one of the problems that they've seen is the dropout rates of girls is very high. And this is linked to school feeding. You know, they're doing school feeding, and so the more you provide school feeding, the more kids, girls stay in school, because then they can take some of the oil home, and it becomes like an avenue for the family to get something to eat. And then the other thing that I've seen in Kenya, for example, the dropout is because of lack of sanitary towels. Every time a girl is having her periods, then she stays at home, even if it is exam time, because they don't have sanitary towels to sit properly in school. Hmm. And so then one person on a radio station like you started to mobilize everyone and said, we must keep more girls in school. And it has become a huge movement where we all buy sanitary towels in the supermarkets and drop them at a point. And all the schools, they distribute sanitary towels the way we distribute other things.
Miriam Sharagoni, Rural Financial Specialist for EFAD. My thanks to her for sharing her thoughts on microcredit and other schemes helping people help themselves. Well, stay tuned to this spot to find out how far I've gotten on this project in coming months. I'll be sure to keep you up to date. That concludes today's program. Thanks for listening. I'm Tracy McClure.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.